rather shame up or care. Let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I am not playing mind games. I am talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions I don't know. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you, except for those two, have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
All right, ciao bello, welcome to Team 33. So we're going to be doing a little Italian striker special at the moment, something we've chatted about outside, myself and Ronan Mullen, who is sitting here. He's our in-house trequartista, to use an Italian term. Yeah. We're also joined by Jonathan Higgins, who is our regista, a position that Liverpool have not filled since Steven Gerrard left the club after, well, when was it, 2014-15?
Yeah, his demise has been in a while. He could have played in Serie A towards the later end of his career, no doubt.
And Colin Buhig, who is going to be our in-house fantasista. That's not an insult. Fantasista actually is a good thing in Italian rather than the translation for fantasist. So.
Thank God I was like Googling here straight away.
So what we were going to do actually, and this blew up on Twitter when we tweeted out that we were going to talk about, like, I suppose, Italian strikers from the golden era. So we're picking kind of the 1990s and then into the 2000s as well. So, well, early 2000s, because that's the era I grew up in. And also, coincidentally, the era of Gazzetta Football Italia. So to start off on actual players, what I wanted to start with was the players who've shown loyalty. And given that Batistuta is probably the person that everyone's talking about, that's the best place to start. And there are certainly two goals that jump out.
Yeah, well, much like any conversation, I always try and bring it back to Gabriel Batistuta because I do love the man. But I tweeted out the goal last night, possibly a bit hyperbolic, but it's probably my favourite goal ever. Just everything around it, the Old Trafford for once was like a cauldron atmosphere, and he just kind of took the air out of the balloon with this ridiculous strike. And it's apt that the De Gea quote unquote mistake at the weekend, because it was deemed to have gone down the middle of his goal, this one right down under the crossbar. And I don't think you'd really blame Mark Bosnich because it flew past him at the speed of light. But Gabriel Batistuta, we hear this thing, YouTube footballer, it's thrown around a lot these days. He was like the pre-YouTube footballer where my dad used to say to me, oh, this guy's unbelievable. He's an unbelievable player. And he probably never seen him play like maybe three or four times. But like there was this cult around him or mystique, which is obviously absent now because any striker or forward player, Gabriel Obertan springs to mind where, you know, you Google him, YouTube him, he's sensational. Then you see him in real life and he's not so much. So that's those kind of factors play into why I love Bosnich.
Yeah, he's a £3 million bargain, Obertan.
That Man United goal, actually, it's even better because of the headband, which was proliferated around Italy in that period as well and just looked good. The Arsenal goal, I thought, also, from that angle.
That's my perfect favourite. Like, he gets the ball and it's like, you think he's no chance here, and he plays the ball to the right and then arrows at top end, the far side. Incredible. Like, it kind of makes me giddy. Like, I was watching back YouTube videos all weekend. I just forgot how much I used to love the guy as a kid. It just, like, when this conversation happens, I was like almost the kind of the showstopper. It's Batistuta, that's it, move on next. He really was an amazing striker, and it's always, I can't help but talk about him with a sense of regret because I'm a huge Liverpool supporter, as I think everybody knows at this rate, but Liverpool were heavily linked with him through the middle of the 90s. Roy Evans, I think, tried to sign him a number of times, and can you imagine partnership of him and Robbie Fowler in the Premiership? That would have been just amazing. So it's always one sense of regret, but what a fantastic footballer.
He leathered that ball like he was angry with it all the time. I mean,
I think the description on Twitter that I think it's a fella called Cahill, so hello Cahill for sending that in, but essentially he hits the ball like the ball's insulted his mother, I think was the
That's
a perfect description.
But that Arsenal goal, the way he just touches it out of his path, and Nigel Winterburn is done. And it's within the second time in a few months, David Seaman was done with that type of shot. Giggs was a few months earlier on the other side, where just out of nowhere, this top corner effort. Like,
but how many of Batistuta goals, like you spoke about the going goals down the middle are high profile given what's happened at the weekend events, but so many Batistuta's goals were just that spot under the crossbar. Yeah. We just leathered them. And,
actually, there's an even better goal, and it actually goes down to the loyalty thing. So obviously.
Sorry. Crazy talk.
Yeah, no, but he left Fiorentina for Roma and went and won the title. Now, he actually scored against Fiorentina in that season, so the 2001 campaign. Yeah. It's a 30-yard volley. you know, straight past the keeper. The only thing, obviously, he doesn't celebrate it. Like, he scored this fantastic goal, but then he looks so distraught. And it's just, it's one of those moments, especially he went down with them, with Fiorentina in 93-94. So, and he decided to stay, which is actually going to be a theme that we'll come back to with others. But given that, like, you can just tell what attachment he had. And obviously the fans love him as well.
His quotes after that game were kind of very much revealing just how much, it's almost like he killed a family member or something like that. He was absolutely distraught because he went through the full evolution with Fiorentina. You know, they went down, came back up, and then they went trying the big push and even bring in Giovanni Trapattoni to try and make one big push, and it just didn't happen, and he had to go almost reluctantly. And then the quotes after that are just kind of sum the guy up, I think.
But he was always different. Didn't he cost something like 23.5 million? As a 30-year-old in Roma, signed him in 2000, won his first title at that age. But also, did I hear he wasn't even the biggest fan of football? He was extra.
He's into polo, basketball, everything that isn't football. I think golf potentially as well. But he kind of
makes me love him more.
Yeah, no. But when I saw the quotes first, I thought he doesn't like football, and he said, "No, he kind of re." That was almost a paraphrase of him, because what he said was he was so driven to succeed that he was almost frustrated by it. Like, if he didn't score another goal, if he didn't get another win, that's what he didn't like, as opposed to not physically enjoying the sport.
But there's a dichotomy there as well, because he was ravaged by injuries towards the end and in subsequent, like, post-football life, where his leg, it might be, again, hyperbolic, but he was saying that he might not need to get his leg amputated. Yeah. But it just shows someone who doesn't love football wouldn't necessarily put themselves through the pain barrier to such an extent that they would require that. So I think it was a bit of a, I don't think he was fully behind that.
I just think he was excellent at it and enjoyed being excellent at it, but probably was just take or leave the sport as a following in general.
But his celebration, you know, I always have the picture in my head, the kind of big oversized Fiorentina shirt, the hair kind of everywhere, sometimes the band, and this big celebration after smashing a volley.
Yeah.
That's kind of when I think back of football as a kid, I think that's what I think back. But I was thinking about it earlier today as well. I don't think we can really have this conversation without touching on him. He isn't really a striker, but he's one of the reasons why I fell in love with Serie A. Paul Gascoigne moving to Italy brought on that famous Channel 4 program and kind of opened up, because you famously kind of described your old man symptoms in last week's Team 33 show, but without going old man-ish, football coverage back then was a total different radar. Back then, you got match of the day, you got an odd FA Cup game here and there. This brought football into our living rooms, and as a kid, and brought so many special moments. And one of the reasons why he fell in love with Battistuta and so many other strikers we will talk about.
Yeah, in terms of the loyalty as well, obviously Totti, you can't, like, I've actually got to see him once in the flesh for about 8 minutes. A famous game, Roma versus Parma, the one time Rome flooded, and I happened to be there to watch a game, and they called it off after 8 minutes, but I got to see Totti. He's one. But the other one that actually jumps out, because Totti never got relegated, that would have been a challenge to see whether he would have stayed at Roma his entire career had they ever gone down. But Del Piero and Trezeguet, actually, and what a partnership as well. Yeah. They both went down to Serie B after all the, what would I describe it, shenanigans.
Del Piero's career was cut in two halves, really, because he had that injury in 1998, and he lost that bit of spark and pace, but his technique never abated, and he was a joy to watch. And I suppose he was the quintessential player that maybe people this side of the world, in the UK and Ireland, looked at as like a brilliant Italian striker, because the name flowed naturally and he was just such a beautiful player. And the tie, not so much the game, but the two legs that stuck out for me was 2003 Juventus Real Madrid in the semi-final, and his performance in those two games, especially at the Bernabeu, was for me like quintessential Del Piero. And of course his goal at Old Trafford against United, as a United fan.
How long before this gets a mention?
Yeah, he did win Capo Canonieri, and it's a good story as well. So 2007-08, so Juventus are back in Serie A after said shenanigans, and himself and Trezeguet are on 19 goals going into the final game of the season. Del Piero, I think, Del Piero scores the first goal, and then he's up to 20, Trezeguet's on 19. He decides to give a penalty that's been awarded to them to Trezeguet, so they're both level on 20, and then Trezeguet returns the favour. So, two absolute legends.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw him actually play for Sydney FC at the very, very end, Del Piero, and even though he could barely run at all, just the class of the guy, the first touch. He's a first touch player.
Just one of those ones. Class,
unbelievable.
My favourite fact about Del Piero is he won the League of Ireland Goal of the Month competition when he scored against Shamrock Rovers. But it's an interesting parallel between himself and Totti, because Del Piero, during his phase of at Juventus, was winning plenty, whereas Totti was in a similar situation, yet not winning very much. like there was kind of a case to be made that Del Piero was in the best possible position. Granted, there was other teams competing, but Roma were always a ways off, and even when they got close, they didn't always finish the job, which makes Totti staying there all the more remarkable. But if he had flitted away towards the end of his career, like Buffon has made that decision, even though he came from Parma and there's stuff behind that, but he's always a Juventus player, whereas now he's got this sort of end game in his career that might diminish things ever so slightly, whereas Totti, even though he was linked, there was never really heavy rumours that he was ever going to leave.
Yeah.
And Daniele De Rossi, who was, I think he came quite close to joining Man United and a couple of other teams, I don't know what it is about the Roman vibe that they just seem so unwilling to.
And the next one, Florenzi, is probably going to be the next one on that line who's going to be there for his entire career. He's a good bit younger, so obviously there's time to change, but it looks like he'll be staying. I mentioned the word capo cannoniere, which of course means top scorer in Italian football. Can't really talk about that without Beppe Signori. Obviously you mentioned Lazio and Gaza. Yeah. He was the guy that was actually finishing off any of the chances on the rare occasions that Gaza actually played.
Yeah, yeah.
One capo cannoniere three times, 93, 4, and 96, and I was just watching footage, like his left foot is a wand, even though he pretty much scored all types of goals with both feet, head, etc.
And a guy who helped Gaza settle in Italy, or settle for a little bit anyway, and just seemed like an all-around gent. And I get that from Gaza in Italy, the book that you had
with Daniel Story.
Yeah, Daniel Story on, and I chatted to Daniel about it too, and it was Signori kept on coming up constantly about a guy who was just so welcoming to Gascoigne to help him, but as you say, what a footballer, and was winning these individual awards when Lazio weren't necessarily the dominant team or anywhere near it at a very, very strong time in Italy. So that just goes to show the class of the guy. And again, another one of those players who just oozes class, like you were saying there a second ago, Del Piero. And there's so many of those in that era, which is like, if you just think about it now in hindsight, and it had that air of mystery too, because it was just before the YouTube generation. So we're just talking about our like four of our memories from it, which makes it even more special.
Only 23 caps as well for Italy, which is mad.
Yeah, so
and
like that.
7 goals, which given that he was top scorer 3 times in the 1990s, it's kind of like a Matt Le Tissier situation. Maybe not quite as stark, but
yeah, definitely.
Enough. Yeah. The other one I'm going to bring up actually is Dario Hubner. So he looks quite odd. He's got a kind of massive black curly hair, this goatee as well. Came late to football. So you're going to, I suppose, if there's an example, it would be Glenn Murray, except if Glenn Murray smoked a pack of cigarettes a day. And he played for Brescia at one time and then moved on to Piacenza. So it's 2001-02. He's joint top scorer that season. But an incredible goals record, and it wasn't just a one-off season. He'd done it with Brescia before, had been relegated with them, had spent most of his career in the lower leagues, and then suddenly found himself scoring regularly at the top level. And also, there was a period where Pirlo was playing behind him at Brescia, and Baggio there as well. And Baggio, of course, you know, what a player.
There is that famous first touch that Baggio has from Pirlo's ball over the top for Brescia. Just one touch taken around the goalkeeper, and he like momentarily loses track of the ball when it comes down. A bit like the Bergkamp-Leicester touch, but you could watch that and repeat all day on YouTube.
Yeah, actually it was Trezeguet, I think, that year actually that Hubner shared it with. But bringing up Baggio, actually, he's one of those cases, and it seems to happen a lot in Italian football, where you play for at least two or three, in his case, with a big three as well, which is remarkable. You know, he was there at Juventus from 1990 to 95, and then he went to Milan for a couple of years, and then to Inter, which is hitting all three.
Yeah, it's obviously something not unique to strikers, but you see it a lot with Christian Vieri going from playing for both Milanese.
Christian Vieri is well known to be prolific on and off the pitch, let me just say that.
We'll leave that there. And the thing about these totemic strikers, I don't know if it's a thing in this part of the world or just outside of Italy, where it's seen as the defensive place to play football, low energy, whereas there's these, as I said, totemic strikers throughout the 90s. I don't know what it is. Like, it's like defences were seen as units, and then these lads were like shining light that actually brought a bit of flair, made it your money's worth in these drab nil-nils.
Yeah.
So that's another interesting element of it. And then you see all these players in later career try to resurrect themselves in the Premier League. Vincenzo Montella springs to mind. He came to Fulham very briefly, shone ever so brightly, and then as soon as he could get back, he was gone. But
there's a few of them that kind of used the Premier League as a retirement home. Well, in some cases, retirement home, or in other cases, to try and revitalise their career. So Vialli, of course, Hullet, if you're counting him as a type of forward. George Weah was at Chelsea and
Man City,
I believe, for a little bit. There's Silenzi, who, he was a bit younger, but trying to revitalise his career maybe, or just a move anyway, went from Torino, where he'd actually scored like 17 goals in one season, and then ended up also moving to Nottingham Forest, where he scored 0 goals and is not remembered fondly. I think he's kind of known as one of the worst signings that the club ever made. Also Dennis Bergkamp, which I think is an interesting case, who failed in Serie A, and Ruben Sosa is a name that jumps out.
There's some sort of, I don't know if you've read the book David Winner did with Bergkamp, but it's just this acrimony between, it's almost unspoken between the two of them, Ruben Sosa and Bergkamp, where they both want to occupy the same positions. It's something you see in football all the time, but it's never as clear as laid out in this book, where Ruben Sosa, his name comes up over and over again. Bergkamp, yeah, someone who failed in Italy, probably for the reasons I mentioned, where it's such a, probably more stilted than the Premier League was at that time, where when he went to Arsenal, he was allowed to flourish in a team where, and Bergkamp was always this outlier where a lot of Dutch players were going to Milan at that time, and he said, rather than go there, I'm going to go to Inter. So he was always a bit of a contrarian on that side of things.
Yeah, because we spoke to Richard Hall of the Gentleman Ultra about that period, why Bergkamp failed, and it was down to the fact, obviously, as you said, that the style of football didn't suit him. Also, his teammates didn't like him, not just Sosa, but I think they found him kind of cold and
aloof.
Unapproachable. Yeah, yeah, aloof. Also, in my ear about a couple of minutes ago, Enda Cull, who is a regular on the main show, suggested Shevchenko. That's him waving there, and that's who I was pointing at earlier. He wasn't just doing that randomly. Shevchenko, of course, two-time Capo Canyonieri with Milan, moved in 1999 after a great season with Dinamo Kiev. I think himself and Rebrov used to have this wonderful partnership.
They destroyed Barcelona at the Nou Camp that year with Kiev.
Yeah. And, of course, he ended up at Chelsea, but I think that's tainted what was actually a superb career. I mean, 24 goals in his first season, I think it was, something along those lines, which, given, you know, Italy's a tough league to move to in the first place, even and especially at that time, it's remarkable.
Yeah. And Fabrizio Ravanelli is another one as well. When he went to Middlesbrough, I thought that was going to be it. And then came back and he won the title under Sven at Lazio, I think, wasn't it? I think that was the year he went back. But when he was finished at Juventus, looked like that was going to be the end for him. I mean, he always looked old anyway with his style. But he went back and had the second part of his career. And his honours list is really impressive because he was there for the peak of Juventus.
With Vialli as
well. Yeah.
And also kind of young Del Piero being there, Baggio being there a little just before the Champions League.
And then he got the double that Lazio got, and they haven't repeated it since in 2000 under Sven.
A lot of deep squads also when you actually kind of look at it as well. I mean, you take the Inter era where Ronaldo was there. Now, obviously, he was injured for quite a while. Didn't really get to play with Vieri. Now, that would have been a strike partnership. If they'd both been fit in and around the same time, would have been amazing. And then you throw in Zamorano was still there, which is a great story as well in terms of fitting players in. You remember the shirt number he would have had. So Baggio had also arrived, so let's throw another great player in. A couple of years later, I think Robbie Keane.
For six games.
Not remembered as a classic striker in that sense, but actually was rated as one of the best young players at the time. But Baggio comes in, has to have the number 10. He's just moved from Juventus, where he's just let it go to Del Piero. Ronaldo was wearing 10 at the time and then obviously had to move to 9, which left Zamorano, who had been wearing 9 at that point, to put the number 18 on. But there's a little thing in between the 1 and 8 that he decided he'd throw in.
Amazing. Unbelievable.
1 plus 8.
Yeah.
It was just crazy, wasn't it?
Madness. But when you look at some of the other kind of deep squads as well, Roma's strike force, actually, the year they won the league.
Unbelievable,
actually, when you think about it, because they had Abel Balbo, who'd been one of their stars in the 1990s, had come back, but he didn't really get to play much. You had Totti, obviously. You had Montella, Del Vecchio, who had a good record of scoring in Rome derbies. And then I'm forgetting somebody as well.
Batistuta.
Yeah. Yes. The great Batistuta.
After all that money, we spoke full circle. 10 minutes Batistuta.
But the other thing as well, I think tactically, why a lot of these teams were able to fit so many players in and not have like too many unhappy players sitting on the bench, you have the Trequartista, which I think is yourself, playing in that kind of number 10 role, floating, and then you have the two strikers as well. So it wasn't a case of now where you can't have four strikers like what Man United would have had the year they won the Champions
League. That's it. That was that time, the late 90s and early 2000s, was a time for really deep striking squads. And Lazio, when they won the league in 2000 as well, they had Salas, Boxic, Mancini. I had to write this down beforehand because I was going to forget Simone and Zaghi, Ravanelli. Like, that was just the strikers. But nowadays, I suppose the quintessential number 9 is not dying off, but it's definitely becoming less regular because it's kind of like an attacking third now, and everyone's in, like, it's quite fluid in the front three and everyone's moving around constantly. You get the exceptions like Harry Kane coming around every so often. Even Harry Kane likes to drop deep, but that was a perfect time for, like you say, the 10 behind the 2 up front.
Yeah, and Inzaghi is actually an interesting story as well. I was looking at his Wikipedia profile. It says he was born in Piacenza. I don't think that's where he's actually born, though. He was born offside.
Hey. I was wondering where he's going with
that. That was terrible. And terrible reaction. Actually, I didn't realise at the time, but apparently him and Del Piero never saw really eye to eye towards the end of their time at Juventus, because obviously he goes on to Milan, has further success, goes and wins Champions Leagues, but they weren't passing to each other apparently around 1999-2000, which
no
was...
No way.
And didn't really seem to see eye to eye off the pitch as well, which is... I suppose another kind of interesting point as well.
Maybe he was annoyed by his excessive celebrations every time he scored from 2 yards out.
The other thing actually that jumped out to me, a few adaptable Germans as well. So one Capo Cannonieri, Oliver Bierhoff, who gets forgotten a bit, and Jürgen Klinsmann, who didn't win top scorer, but Klinsmann's well remembered at Inter. Obviously he was there at the very start of the 90s because he learnt German. It's kind of like what he did at Tottenham as well. He did that dive celebration. He was a German coming to England, which is not always the most popular thing, but he endears himself. And Bierhoff, having spent, surprisingly, I would have thought his career would have taken him to the Bundesliga first, but he was at Ascoli for a few years, then goes to Udinese, becomes Serie A top scorer, and then goes to Milan, where he helps them win the league in that first season in 98-99, because they'd had a few bad years, and which leads me to a period further back, George Weah.
I was just thinking that that goal against Verona, I mean...
His goals record's not especially...
I know, but...
mad, in, or at least brilliantly brilliantly crazy, but it's just obviously the Verona goal kind of wipes everything away.
That's the thing about that period, because it's so nostalgic that you look back and you forgo all the like average records, especially for like wonder moments like that, but that was an absolutely ridiculous goal, that way of goal.
Yeah, such a... I remember when he came, was it, I think it was Viali was still the manager of Chelsea when he came on Chelsea on loan. I remember just being so excited to see this guy, and I think what it kind of summed up the memories I have of him is just incredibly talented, could literally shimmy the ball either way, could turn on a sixpence, but probably should have scored a hell of a lot more goals and should have been a lot more, probably had more talent to be even better than it was, but you still have, you know, was one of those players that goes, wow, George Weah, here we go. But yeah,
and another cult hero. Of course, before Weah as well, because he was in, I suppose, a long-term sense replacing arguably one of the, well, probably one of the top five strikers of all time, Marco van Basten. So
yeah, and I mean, that was one of the cruelest endings to a career, the premature nature of it, but he'll always have Euro 88, and that, like, so many of his, like, fellow great strikers cite that as the best goal they've ever seen, just because of how ridiculous it was to even shoot from there. Like, the start of the show, the Batistuta Arsenal goal was almost irresponsible to shoot from where he did, and it went in top
corner. I'll give you another example of somebody who, but it wasn't in Serie A, unfortunately, but it was when he went to Atletico Madrid, but Vieri, there's one where he scores.
Unbelievable.
There's no way he should be scoring from where he is, but he's actually literally on the sideline. The goalkeeper is obviously not in the goal, otherwise what would have been the worst goalkeeping mistake of all time, but he actually curls it in from an obscene angle.
Yeah, it makes Canu's effort at Stamford Bridge seem quite average. Yeah, it is ridiculous.
By far, yeah. But certainly, like, it's a pity, as you said, it's a pity we never got to see much of Van Basten in the 90s after, I think, 92, 93, where a Basil Boli tackle for Marseille was well, he'd had a few ankle injuries, but that seemed to be the kind of death knell of his career, unfortunately, and like, I didn't really get to see him live. I've just had the, I suppose, the luck of YouTube and etc. to
goal named after him, which is it's incredible. You just remember that goal or that type of volley, so
yeah. There was a few at Parma. Sorry, go.
No, I was just going to say, probably without preempting your next question, but comparatively now, is there a dearth of attacking talent in Europe, or is it just that Serie A is no longer the hub where all these brilliant like musicians get together and perform? You know, it's like, it seems they're just scattered around Europe more so. Is that the case, or do you think there's a reason why there's an absence of...
Well, obviously Serie A was kind of the top leagues, and I guess in one way we didn't really touch on the real Ronaldo properly, but I mean, he was at Barcelona, obviously, where he scored a great goal against, I think, Compostela, I think it was. And then he's brought on a world record fee to Inter. And actually, when you look at a lot of these strikers, most of them went, even within the league itself, for world record fees. So you had these very wealthy owners. They're obviously trying to, in a very competitive league, maybe in a way that the Premier League is, if maybe more teams were involved in the title races, but they're all seeking that title, and they all have that kind of belief that maybe they can do it, maybe with that great striker. And I think it's that kind of case that they were just able to amass the best talent in Europe, bar maybe one or two exceptions that played in other leagues.
Yeah, even from the Premier League's perspective, it was seen as the zenith is playing in Serie A.
Yeah.
And like, everyone had such respect for those players. And even as a United fan, when Italian teams came to Old Trafford on a Champions League night, you'd be terrified. Nowadays, not so much. And yeah, it's moved elsewhere, and it's just not in Italy at the moment where the power is.
Yeah. Now, the Premier League was able to pull a few players. We mentioned, obviously, there's the ones that use as a retirement home. I think Crespo was a bit stronger when he was at Chelsea.
Yeah.
He wasn't completely at the tail end of his career. Tino Asprilla, a very different story.
He ruined Newcastle's title, but still, it was what a party.
What a character. Someone to go on a party with.
Oh my God. Yeah, there's that story when he signed, the day he signed for Newcastle, they were against Middlesbrough. And Keegan bought him for a champagne reception, had a little like glass of champagne, and was on the bench that day, later that day, and came on for a little cameo. But it didn't really affect his performance, because he played like it was a party all the time. And when that finish, I know we're talking Italy, but that finish against Liverpool outside the right foot in the first 4-3, it's one of the best Premier League goals I've ever seen. Asprilla was a joy.
Another honourable mention, and actually to think about these Roma teams with great strikers, but Antonio Cassano, a wasted talent, but there's some great stories, not so much from Roma, where he seemed to fall out with everybody eventually, but Real Madrid, where he had extracurricular activities in his hotel room, but he also made friends with the bellboy, so that person would actually send up like croissants after he'd finished the business he was doing within the said hotel bedroom. But he's some character. He's one of those I thought would never play in a World Cup, but fortunately, although it wasn't a great one for Italy. Just to finish off, I guess, and even to mention people like, you know, Simone Inzaghi is one we never really touched on too much. Marcelo Salas, another. I think did he terrorise Man United?
In the Super Cup,
yeah, I remember. Yeah.
But Luca Toni, World Cup winner.
Oh yes, Luca Toni. You were going to bring up Massimo Macaroni as well.
I love all these obscure Italian ones, even not so obscure Marco Di Vaio, all these kind of guys.
Marco Di Vaio, who had a great career at Salernitana.
I want to give a shout out for Adriano as well, just because of his Pro Evo days.
Just put him on his left.
Just get the ball and shoot. I'll call it research. It wasn't really. It was a pleasure to look back and just go rare his YouTube videos last night. But so many Adriano's goals were literally, he gets the ball, he takes a shot, he takes a touch, he puts it onto his left foot and he smashes. And it didn't matter where he was on the pitch. And he just like put this absolutely cannon drive towards the goal.
The collective fear of the opposition.
Yeah. And hearing even like Ibrahimovic talking about him, you know, how he wanted him. He demanded that he stayed at the club. I think it was at Inter at the time together. It was AC at the time together. And, you know, but he always feel like he could have done so much more because he was just an absolute beast of a striker. It's just, but one of those that it'll always have that memory, if only for Pro Evo alone.
So to finish off, pick one striker from that whole list of people we talked about, the one that really stands out. Actually, we'll just call it the not baddest dude around, because I think...
You've killed me.
Let's finish it off. You know what? I'm going to say that the guy who sums it up for me is Pippo Inzaghi, just because of his outrageous celebrations.
Yeah.
The second 2007 Champions League final, second goal hits his back. He acts like it's the best goal of all time. That sums up Inzaghi for me. That sums up Italian strikers for me.
You had to run that off, didn't you?
Yeah.
Obviously, if this is a non-baddest studio, that he's the one for me. I'll go a little bit off kind of... from the norm, Viali for me, just for the amount of overhead kicks that he scored.
Yeah.
I remember as a kid wondering how the hell he could do that and fell on my ass so many times in the garden trying to copy him, but that's for me.
And Rowan?
Yeah, given bad suitors off the table, I'm going to go with Totti for the reasons I mentioned earlier, just this the Roman flair and the commitment to the cause that is pretty much unparalleled during his time in Italy, so I'm going to go with him.
I'll go Christian Vieri, very interesting fella. Now runs, I think, well, he's involved in some fashion ventures now with Paolo Maldini. Very, very interesting on and off the pitch, which is where we'll leave it before we say anything that we shouldn't say. But you can still tweet in any suggestions you want of players that we may have missed out on. We're always going to do that because there was such a collection of strikers in Serie A at the time. But anyway, thanks for listening in. We're going to just play the little sound of Gareth Bale trying to speak Spanish.
No estamos contentos con el resultado contra Sporting. Estamos ilusionados. Queremos ganar contra el Betis. Y yo espero jugar buen fútbol para la afición.
All right, that is Gareth Bale speaking Spanish as recently as 2015, and unless his level of Spanish has actually dropped to an unacceptable level in 5 years of living, or 4 years actually of living in Spain, then I don't know what's going on. But that is actually in relation to Marcelo and Courtois, who have both, within the Real Madrid dressing room, spoken a little bit publicly, and probably not in the nicest way about Gareth Bale. But anyway, here to discuss
Joe Coffey and Killian Woods, who has departed our Galway studio for now, which I think is undergoing renovations or upgrades or something. I'm not sure what the situation
is. It's just a laptop on Skype over in the west of Ireland.
Yeah. Now, this Real Madrid situation has obviously evolved. It's not just about Bale and his unhappiness there, but also Zinedine Zidane is making a saviour return.
Jesus Christ incarnate has returned.
Yes. I was shocked at that, actually.
I
to a degree.
No,
all the talk was Mourinho, and Zidane had kind of. I thought he'd left in a way that maybe.
Well, they'd approached him and he turned them down, and then he said he would be prepared to consider it if it was June. But they obviously came. I think the whole reason he left in the first place, so the story goes, is that he wanted much more input into the direction of the team and what personnel the team would be made up out of. And Perez wasn't prepared to give him that kind of input, in that he sold Ronaldo, the person who was getting all the goals, and was like, no, you're going to have to make do with Gareth Bale, who, by all accounts, Zidane didn't want in the team anyway.
Sure, he left him out of the Champions League final.
Well, I think, in fairness, you could argue that he was leaving him out of the Champions League final team because he'd be working on them, bringing them, like, because he was coming back from a long-term injury and all that, and he was working on bringing them back bit by bit into the team. As they might say on Match of the Day or some other show, he didn't fancy him.
No, he did not. But the weird thing is, and this was a production meeting that happened on Twitter, Joe, you decided we're going to talk about this.
Oh yeah, well,
but it was just some of the comments from Marcelo and Courtois particularly I thought were, like, I mean, if you're saying in a private setting, fine, but like, read this from Marcelo in Esporte Interativo. Bale does not speak Spanish, as he only speaks English and we talk with gestures. That's one translation of it, a translation by AS. But now I don't have anyone next to me since Kiko Casilla left. There's nobody there on the other side in the dressing room. I have Bale, but he doesn't say anything. He only speaks English, so you can imagine what that's like. I'm like, hey, hi, hello and goodbye. I mean, it's very revealing, and maybe he meant it semi-jokingly, but
it's very
it's a weird joke. If it was,
yeah.
It's amazing how Real Madrid are going through this phase of playing out their dressing room meltdown all on social media. I mean, you had Sergio Ramos conduct, you know, saying there's been a few questions around, and I'm going to answer them all directly now. Which really, when you went down to the questions from answer, what was it? It was like, you know, are you all arguing in the dressing room? And he's like, sometimes words or say it or all this kind of,
he essentially said, I'm going to do a bare all interview, and then he said, actually, I can't talk about that.
Yeah, it was like that is PR, not appropriate. It was like he had a PR person telling him exactly what to say.
But there was also another row apparently with Ramos and Perez in the dressing room after the Ajax game, which was actually quite good as well. Perez, obviously being club president, can pretty much do what he wants. He comes into the dressing room. Ramos, of course, missed the game because there was a deliberate yellow card. UEFA had banned him, and he was up in the stands getting
filmed.
But
he put his hands up, and he's taken on responsibility.
Mr. 200% is now his nickname, I think.
Yeah, but being filmed for an Amazon documentary or something in the stands.
Well, as he said himself, these things were negotiated long before he lived to see Real Madrid fold at the hands of Ajax.
Yeah, but then Ramos and Perez both in the dressing room at the same time after that game, and I think Perez had threatened to sack him or something in front of the whole squad, and then Ramos kind of stood up and said, well, just pay me and then I'll go.
I mean, the reality is, it all comes down to the simple fact that they sold Ronaldo and they had nobody to replace him.
Yes, and then obviously Zidane walking out, who's the only man who's been able to control that dressing room.
But in reality, the reason I think we can say Zidane left was probably, if you look back, the fact that he's going, well, hang on, they're selling Ronaldo and they're telling me I have to make do with Gareth Bale, who I don't rate. This is only going to end one way for me, so I'm going to leave now. And I mean, who knows what was going on in Zidane's head, but now he's coming back to a system where he's probably been given free rein.
Yeah, but I think I might take a bit of the credit I gave him for when he left. Because when he left, I thought, oh, maybe he has a bit of as he said there, he's thinking about it sensibly. He's thinking, I've gotten the most out of this team. How do you follow up the Champions Leagues in a row that I've won? But now going back, I think it's very, very dodgy. Like, you know, it's like the kind of Brendan Rodgers effect. Celtic are ready to have, you know, roll out the carpet of Brendan Rodgers, have the statue outside the stadium, record-breaking seasons. And now all of a sudden, he's public enemy number one. Is Zidane risking ruining his legacy
Well, you go back to a club, you always risk.
There's no question there. He is risking ruining his legacy despite being their most successful coach in history.
But I think the problem for Zidane, and you know, it might be a bit like the Solskjaer effect, where Zidane is just perfectly matched to Real Madrid, and I don't know if there any other club that he'd be matched to. In terms of his ethos, in terms of in terms of his knowledge of the inner workings of the club and how to get the best out of the players in the squad, I mean, he seems to be well matched to it. And I don't subscribe to this idea that these days that you have to
learn your trade in the lower leagues.
That's how we're going. That you have to learn your trade. Not these days, because managing an international football club, effectively, let's say Real Madrid are an international football club without playing in the World Cup, if you know what I mean, is very different to managing, they're like two different sports, managing a team in the lower leagues versus managing Real Madrid. Because you're managing personalities. I mean, all these players know how to play football, but you're managing how to get the best out of them. And these days, especially for a club like Madrid, unless you have a load of accolades as a manager behind your name, like Mourinho or something.
Didn't save him in the end.
Well, but he got the best out of, he still got the best out of the team, though.
For a while, yeah.
Yeah, like he won the league and got an insane, 100 points or something with them?
Yeah.
And when Barcelona were unbelievable. So he did get the best out of the team, he just didn't last very long. But so if you don't have that, and you know, then you need to be a footballer who's done it all. And Zidane has done it all. Like, he's won the World Cup, he's won the Champions League. You know, he was
one of the best players of his generation.
Yeah, it's the same thing as having Johan Cruyff in charge of Barcelona. It's the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So it's a big risk to him coming back. But I think if he has more input into the type of players Madrid need to get, or acquire, then I think it'll work out okay for him.
Do you think he can repeat his success? I think this is going to crash and burn. I think this is a terrible idea.
I wasn't sure of him as a manager anyway in the first place, though, because he has three Champions Leagues, and
I think for Madrid now, I think if they go back to basics, I think the goal for Madrid actually in the immediate future will be to win the league. Because they haven't won it in so long.
They've only won it twice in the last 10 years. Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
Champions Leagues are the only currency in town a lot of the time, but they've won three of them. So maybe their goal will be, well, we want to beat Barcelona and win the league.
He wasn't very good at that either.
Won one of them. But who's to say that he won't have a different focus now? I'm not saying I'm not saying, oh, he's definitely going to be a success. I'm just saying that, like, you can see where the attraction comes from, where he might be looking at going, well, look, it's, you know yourself, like, it's like somebody comes to you with an offer for a job, you turn down that and say, no, it's not enough. And then they suddenly find, Jesus, we can't get anyone that's as good as that person that we let go. And then they come back to you and go, look, we can't get anybody else, will you please do it? And then you go, well, look, I will, but the price has just gone up, you know. So I think he's coming back into it. Without knowing anything about it, you're only assuming. But surely the reason he's decided to come back into it after such a short space of time is that Perez has effectively begged him to come back. That's what I would think. Because it doesn't make any sense otherwise to leave the job in August and then to come back the following March. I mean, that's not a long while, particularly as reports were saying earlier.
Well, left in June, I think, just after that.
Sorry, left in June, yeah. Like, particularly for reports to be believed that he was approached initially, said no, and then they were humming and hawing about Mourinho. And then when everyone thought Mourinho was going to be unveiled, all of a sudden Zidane just appears out of nowhere at the last minute as the manager. Because it was kind of like Zidane had been mentioned, and it was like, no, he's turned that down. And then on Monday, suddenly report comes out, oh, Zidane's going to be the new manager. You know, so something changed very quickly over the course of the couple of days from Champions League exit to him being given the job.
Yeah.
But like, he does have, like, the first thing he'll have to do anyway is, and it'll be this summer, I mean, Gareth Bale, is surely his time at Madrid is over now.
Well, like, the noises from the media, like the Spanish or the Madrid media, to give it more of a name, because given Spain's very diverse in terms of the papers that they're in the regions, but they seem like their guns are out for him and have been, well, they have been for a long time, but it just seems like the noise is that big now that it's inevitable he's going to leave.
Yeah, and
great news for a Premier League club, because he's going to go at a slash price. They're essentially going to be offering him around. And
I'm not saying
he's going to be going for
but
free.
See, the problem is he's 30. He's going to be 30 in the summer.
Still, I think he's...
But how many clubs out there are going to be lining up to spend, I don't know, I could say Madrid, for who knows what Madrid would be looking for. But like, you can be sure that their evaluation after what they paid for him is going to be pretty high.
Yeah, because they got about 100 million for Ronaldo. Million. But Ronaldo's an exception.
But after Ronaldo would have got 100 million off most clubs that could afford it, I think.
Yeah, but he's an exception.
He's an exception. Yeah. But like,
Bale will go for less. But.
Oh, yeah. Well, particularly because Bale has a massive history of injuries. Ronaldo, to be honest, is a phenomenon in that he rarely gets injured.
Yeah.
Bale has had big injuries pretty much every season since he signed for Madrid.
Was he an average of 28 games a season or something like that? Something very low.
Something like that, yeah. Like his first season, he scored 22 goals and he's yet to repeat that feat.
Yeah, he scored arguably more important goals in that last few years than Ronaldo.
That has saved any remnants of his Real Madrid career. Is that, you know, he does seem to pop up those important moments and score.
Yeah, sure. There was
goals.
That great goal against Barcelona in the Copa del Rey final. Yeah, there's the Champions League ones as well.
A few Champions League. There was one against Atletico, wasn't it? Well, Ronaldo scored the winning. The headline is Ronaldo scores the winning goal. He scored the third goal of an extra time rout.
It wasn't even the third. It was the fourth.
Fourth, and Bale, but Bale got the one that actually edged the game.
No, but you see, Ronaldo played it very well because he ripped off his shirt and ran from the camera. So he knew what image they'd use.
But that's a sign of someone who's unbelievably in tune with. Well, it was for a movie, I think, or something like that as well.
I think he was making
a movie about his life at the time, and that's what it was for. It was actually Johnny Giles who was quick to point it out. The one thing I remember after that, I remember thinking it was weird that he ripped off his jersey and flexed. And Johnny Giles said in the studio afterwards, he's like, "Oh, I bet you he's making a movie. That's why he did that." And he was right. I'm pretty sure he was making a movie at the time. But because it was the 2014. There was a video. It was a whole movie based around the 2014 World Cup and all that kind of stuff.
I think the issue is
most clubs in England, you'd be suddenly just be regarded as a legend. Doesn't really matter what you do, you'd be regarded as a legend after the goals Bale has scored. In a place like Madrid, they only ever seem to operate on you're as good as your last game. And that's why they go through, like, that's why Ronaldo was super successful, because he always, to be honest, he just always scored goals. But that's why they go
to... But even, like, he would have got booed. He didn't, the board weren't always in love with him. Like, those fans can be very fickle. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
Like Bale scored a bicycle kick in the Champions League final. He's getting booed a few months later. Ronaldo, even when he was, like, he might stop scoring for... And I'm not sure if he's... We're recording this during a Champions League game involving Juventus and Atletico Madrid, and there seems to be some refereeing decision. But the point is, Ronaldo used to get booed even at the height of his Real Madrid career, which was a bit mad given...
They literally operate on a basis that, well, the last game is the only game that matters. And that's why they seem to go through managers very quickly as well, because you have managers there who might win the league and get to the Champions League final, and then they might lose a couple of games the following season and they're sacked. You know, so, Gareth Bale has had a really successful career at Madrid, no matter what way you look at it. He's won pretty much everything going. But I do think if there was a top four club in the Premier League interested in him, I think it would be excellent for the Premier League for him to come back.
Of course not.
You'd have to spend a lot of money, but I think he has a lot to offer for a couple of seasons anyway, and I think a reduced role as time goes on.
A swap for Hazard or something like that.
It looks like Hazard's going to go anyway.
Well, to be honest, I think Chelsea, it'd be a good idea for Chelsea because Chelsea are in this transfer embargo now.
Because of the appeal.
It's paused. So, they did last time, they load up on players
The big issue Chelsea have is how much money do they have. So, I mean, and like the way it worked out for Arsenal, I remember when Arsenal were selling Alexis Sanchez, the best thing that happened to the club was the fact that they decided to go for Mkhitaryan instead of looking for money. Effectively, I would have felt as a fan that if Arsenal had gotten money from Sanchez, it would have been just swallowed up by the club. But we actually ended up getting a player out of it who would have cost 10 or 15 million if we wanted to buy him. We probably would never have bought him. And he's starting to show his worth. Particularly after his injury, but I think that Ronaldo or not Ronaldo, but Bale, I think for the likes of Chelsea, it could be something like that would make sense, because then at least you're getting a player who arguably is of equal ability to Hazard, if not greater.
I think the Real Madrid would, I see some of the players there, and it's all hearsay who they're linked with. I think it's not looking good for them rebuilding their new team. I think it's very much Hazard will be a terrible buy. Hazard, you couldn't convince me to buy Hazard for my team for the money, because he's definitely not a Real Madrid style player, because the fans will turn on him. Imagine Hazard having that Chelsea. Remember the season just after the season Chelsea won the league, Hazard didn't do anything of substance until April in a game against Tottenham.
Bale
hasn't even done anything on that scale.
Yeah.
Hazard was playing that season, he just did nothing of substance. After being player of the year, Hazard will be swallowed up by Real Madrid. I think I've seen before people writing in the English media saying Hazard's best, if he was smart he'd stay at Chelsea, because Chelsea is his level. Chelsea's a level where he can stand out, but if he's also going to have a dip, no one will really get on his back about it. I mean, no one has gotten his back. Chelsea fans haven't turned on Hazard, and they have every right to turn on Hazard.
Hazard is a player who I think could do with Pep Guardiola coaching him.
I guess. Any player would probably do well.
Certain players in particular, like Hazard is an unbelievable player, but I think he could be even better.
As in the way he's change Raheem Sterling and the likes of Sané as well.
I think Guardiola could do an awful lot of work with. Like, there's some players I think he could do a lot of work with. Like, I wouldn't be saying that, like, Pep Guardiola could do a lot of work with Aubameyang, for example. But for the likes of Hazard, I think he could, you know?
Yeah, he's got the technical side of it.
Yeah, like Hazard's a brilliant player, but he always gives me the impression that he actually could be even better.
If he was consistent, he'd be probably at he'd be probably in that level near the bracket of Messi, Ronaldo.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
I
think Madrid are on the cusp of another Galactico couple of seasons where they sign a load of players.
And you mean by that, like, it isn't like a to their own fault success?
I don't know, to be honest with you. It may be that they buy a load of superstar players and it takes a while to mesh them all together. But I think that's when they're talking about rebuilding the team now, that's usually Madrid's style. Let's just go out and buy a load of superstar footballers and see what happens.
Yeah, and sometimes it does come off for them. Just the Courtois comments as well, which were a little, like, the Marcelo one was kind of possibly meant in a joking sense that he can't speak Spanish, but the Courtois ones, it's that whole thing where they went out for dinner as a team and Bale and Toni Kroos decide they're not coming. But I thought it was a bit odd, because, like, Bale's a footballer, he's supposed to have a certain disciplined lifestyle, but Bale had told the squad, "I'm not coming to join you guys, I go to bed at 11. And also, but probably even the more damning thing, the fact they call him the golfer, because he spends all his time on the golf course rather than with the squad. Now,
I can relate to the bed thing, that sounds very appealing.
Yeah, that one I'm actually fine. That's fine, because he's a footballer, I'm sure his lifestyle prior to Real Madrid, like in Spain's kind of, your lifestyle is quite different in that you will eat dinner later, etc., etc. But that's not an issue. The golf thing, I thought, was the more pointed remark, that it seems like he just goes off, does his own thing, does not mix with the squad, I think was the underlying thing.
But even if he does, like, there's players on every team that don't mix with the squad and prefer to do their own thing. What I wonder about all this is that, like, you know, what has he actually done for people to effectively be bitching about him like this in the media? I mean, like, he's you know, he doesn't come across as someone who's incredibly arrogant.
No, he's supposed to be really quiet.
Other than his comments right after the Champions League final, which, you know, he just scored a bicycle kick, one of the greatest goals I've ever seen in the Champions League final, so you could probably argue that he's well entitled to be saying it, where he was saying, "I need to be playing every week. You know, I need to be playing football now every week." And then, you know, he starts playing football every week and doesn't really work out. So, like, maybe players didn't like that, but
I don't think they would have cared much, because it's a squad.
And it's
where,
just after, yeah, you know, so...
No, like, I'm sure they heard the comments well after, but also that squad, like, their egos are probably bigger than their own talent, so they only really care about their own bottom line. Yeah. I don't think they really care what Ronaldo, Bale,
Ronaldo can get away with whatever Ronaldo wants to do, because ultimately, as all players on the team will agree, well, look, we're willing to put up with that because we're winning all these competitions and making, you know, all this money because of him. It's the same way where you know, people might give out about Tiger Woods, but then you look at, well, hang on now, look how much money the PGA Tour was pulling in 1996 versus what the PGA Tour pulls in prize money in 2016, you know, which was, you know, multiples. Same, it's, you know, like it's the same effect if you're, it's the same thing in UFC if you're talking about Conor McGregor, where in terms of the amount of money they've made versus before versus after, you know, like, I mean, I think when you're looking at sport, you'll certainly pull up with an awful lot if that person is able to prove themselves valuable to you in some form. And with Ronaldo, I mean, you put up with everything in terms of the arrogance and the look at me attitude. When you know you're winning pretty much all the games and you're winning all your big games and you're winning the Champions League multiple times.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's maybe unfair to kind of get down on Bale. Again, maybe there's stuff we're not seeing. I it's like my complaints about Zidane is like, you know, it's hard to respect him for what he achieves on as a coach when you really all the evidence is there that he's not doing anything. That was a huge segue. But same with Bale.
I still can't believe he's like.
Sorry, this for listeners, I'm not going to go into it, but it's in reference to something that
a joke of a coach. Yeah, something. Is effectively, what he's saying.
Well, actually, he has won 3 Champions Leagues, but.
If we're gonna go,
I'm not
there,
sure about him.
We had this argument. We've had this argument.
I thought you were on my side of this argument.
No.
You think he's a genius.
I know. I was saying that.
I'm not gonna put words in your mouth. Yeah. I
did say he was a great coach.
Oh, I died.
And you, we had this argument back in the summer.
Goes down to the definition of coach and manager. You know, yeah. I think Alex Ferguson is a good manager.
When I say coach, I actually mean manager because I do think he's a great manager of the players.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then there's where we're in agreement. I think if you give two managers,
it's more fun we disagree. Kevin.
Yeah, it is more fun we disagree. As we say in the production meeting, yeah. Who's drawn the short straw this week? But with Zidane, like I shared in the group WhatsApp group yesterday, that kind of, and again, this is an insight that's tailored that they want us to see. It's where he's talking about like G'ing up the players for the second half of the Champions League final, and he's saying just keep, or it's a Champions League game anyway that UEFA shared yesterday after he was reappointed. It's like just keep, and I think his point is keep the ball, passing the ball, keep it on the ground, move it to the wings, don't go through the centre, we will score, just keep passing the ball, keep attacking. You're like very basic nonsense.
But look at everything Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has said since he got the United job. It's all basic mumbo jumbo.
But it's infuriating.
Do you know what he said recently? He said they were all about the injuries United had, and he was like, "Well, it's great. It gives me a chance to try out some of the younger players."
I mean, can you? I wonder.
I think it's completely bonkers.
Imagine managers. Like, I suppose Pep Guardiola seems to think so hard about what he does. He goes away. He takes time away to think about it. I wonder how, if he's infuriated looking at someone like Zidane, who just kind of clicks his fingers and gets what he wants.
Zidane's like that guy in school who
doesn't do homework, just does the homework, or can just listen in class and is a genius.
But maybe because he has natural ability and is a genius.
Maybe
Pep has to work really, really hard to get to that level. Whereas Zidane just knows it and he can see it.
It's been pointed out by so many different people. Again, it's part of the Man City documentary, which is you can read somewhat into, where Fabian Delph is like mouthing off in the dressing room when they're losing one of their games, and he's like, just do the basics, just, you know, everyone pass the ball. And Pep Guardiola is melting in his head. He's like, you are an idiot. Stop talking. You're not even in the hierarchy of being a captain in this club. Who gave you permission to talk? You are talking nonsense. Again, you see him so mad at Fabian Delph for saying, what are you even talking about? You're not even saying anything of substance.
I saw Wenger as a pundit, or as an analyst.
It sounds like you were cheating up to stay at the Mayo game of the weekend or something. I saw Wenger.
but he was analysing the United Paris Saint-Germain match last week. And it is true, like, when you're looking, you know, the way he was talking about the game, he was talking about it, and I know this sounds a bit, you know, this sounds a bit like, oh, but
he was what? A bit ageist? Where are you going with your, where's this going?
No, well, it sounds a bit poncy, like, to be saying that, like, he was speaking about the game in a completely different way to what we'd be used to in terms of watching former players talk about the game.
You mean in a more intelligent or more
higher level?
Oh yeah, okay, that's good. That's not.
Oh yeah, like you're kind of going, oh well, he talks about the game in such a different way to everybody else. You know, it sounds a bit like that, but he was making points before the match about why PSG. And then this is what I can never understand. I mean, he's making all these points, and you're going, Jesus, yeah, I didn't realise that.
Why didn't you do that at Arsenal?
And then I'm kind of going, but how are you so bad at Arsenal for the last 4 years when you're making all this stuff? And I'm going, God, he's dead right. How did I not see this? You know. So, but it is true, like that. It's amazing when you see, like, basically, I'm going back to what you're saying about Guardiola, where you have Fabian Delph saying just do the basics and all that, yeah. and then you have somebody else going who sees the game. Like, you know, sometimes you hear people talk about football, and I don't think I'm one of these, but sometimes you hear people talk about football in a way that you go, wow, it, like, you could be speaking a different language in terms of, it's on another level of thinking.
And I think there's a room for both of them in the game. I think there's room for the Zidanes who like Avram Grant. Avram Grant was one of the only men who could have led that Chelsea team, because he didn't, to that Champions League final. Because what it needed, and I'm not sure if he knew this, what it needed, someone who had literally no charisma and no authority to be there to talk to the BBC after the game while letting the players do what they want. Aww. Like, it needed someone with, this sounds like I'm going to defame him, no backbone at all.
Oh, would you stop?
No, but do you know what I mean? Like, because that's what led them. That's why they did it. It's because he didn't really care that John Terry, Peter Cech, actually brought them to that Champions League final. And he didn't mind. He wasn't seething. He wasn't like, because if a manager saw their players kind of taking over control, he might mouth off and he's like, who do you think you are? Get out of the dressing room. And then that caused a bit of ruckus. Whereas he was just happy to sit back and let the players bring him. And maybe he's a genius. See, this is the thing. It's hard to know because we don't know what narrative were fed from the dressing room.
I'd say we could effectively paint any manager of a top level team as a genius.
That's the thing, because you don't know. Maybe he saw, do you know what? If I just let John Terry think he's in charge, or let John Terry if I take on board certain things he says, or like that, he'll do the leading for me, you know. Which might be good man management. Maybe Fergie did that. Maybe Zidane is doing that as well. He's saying, I know exactly how to let Ramos think that he controls his dressing room when actually I'm the one. Or maybe it's a case of sitting down with Ramos and thinking, Ramos, look, I know you were the most powerful person in the dressing room. I need you on my side. Same with Ronaldo. You're my three men. This doesn't leave this room, but we need to work together. And whether that is me throwing another player on the bus, or maybe me pulling a player you'd like to say that to without annoying them, you know, we can work as a team here.
Yeah.
That's man management. Coaching then is where I think Guardiola will be better. Is that I think he, if he was given five players, he could work out the best way to get the ball in the back of the net. Whereas tell them away them, if you pass the ball in this way, it'll disrupt the other defense. One player will be drawn out and that will score. Whereas Zidane is just better at knowing how not to annoy people, and when people aren't annoyed, or some people perform quite well when they're annoyed, when they're not annoyed, or the dressing room is as balanced or is happy with life, will perform better. Maybe that's good man management.
Well, I think a lot of it will come down to, look, it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, that Madrid team that Zidane had, it never really changed that much. The 3 years they won the Champions League, like, I mean, effectively the team was built around Ronaldo, so it didn't really matter, like, in many ways you kind of go, well, it didn't really matter who was on the team. Now he has to actually build a team. So you'll get a really good idea of his knowledge of football. I think if he wins a league, he'd be vindicated, I think, in many ways. In terms of his approach and his knowledge, you'll have to go, well, he's won the league now as well, you know, maybe. Like, the fact that he has to go ahead now and organise this team post-Ronaldo, it will be a massive challenge.
You know, I would have to back then, not that Zidane's worried about what I'm saying over here in Dublin, but, like, you know, I think you'd have to back down after if he does pull this off. And he's responsible for the players who come in and responsible for, you know, the layout of the team. You'd have to stand back and say, okay, there's more at the moment, and it's so weird, it's so awful to be able to, it doesn't make any sense to be able to say it, but I think it's very hard to read into what he's achieved so far as a coach. But if he was to now build a new team, as you said there, well, like, it would be hard to dispute.
There's often, that statement's often said about brilliant teams kind of going, oh, shit, there's so many good players, anyone. Like, you know, people say, you know, there's so many great players, they could manage themselves to a Champions League or a Premier League or whatever. But the one thing I will say, and I actually think Mourinho has proven this, is that man management and your approach to players is these days just as important as your tactical knowledge. Because, I mean, the one big change I've observed, and I would presume a lot of people would be thinking the same, with Mourinho, like in the, you know, the pre-2010 Mourinho versus the current Mourinho, is that, like, he didn't go around blaming players. Like, no. And if he did blame players, it never happened in the media. Whereas this thing really seeped in after Madrid, of this thing of having this deep mistrust of players. I mean, and you know, like, people are out to sabotage
well,
this club.
It probably just tells you how bad things were at Real Madrid within the dressing room, the relationship with the manager.
Oh, well, like,
his whole approach to life and management completely changed. Well, at least management changed.
Well, you could argue, like, I know Chelsea won a Premier League title with him, but you could argue that, you know, he hasn't been the same since. I mean, his United experience definitely is the least successful experience of his career, despite what trophies he has to show for it, in terms of, like, he did okay, but it probably, like, I mean, that must have been the most unsatisfying second place I've ever seen a Premier League team get, was United's second place last year.
I'm not sure who would remember that they finished second that year, given, well, like, City were so far ahead.
The other day it was said that, I can't remember who said it in the papers, that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has given that team something to cheer about again. It's like, they won the UEFA Cup or the Europa League. Like, it's not like Mourinho didn't give them anything, but how unenjoyable winning a trophy was.
He does have the challenge, though, now, like, okay, this is probably a nice way to segue into the big events of the weekend, Raph.
Yes. I'm actually curious now how you're going to do this.
Where Ole Saviour was slain at the Emirates. By the big guns of by the sweet left foot of Granit Xhaka.
Yeah,
make your point, Joe. Yeah.
What?
Make your point.
Anyway,
segue made.
Yeah. I think the Solskjaer has the big challenge now that, okay, United have finally lost it. I think this is their first Premier League game.
First league
lost,
yeah.
Yeah. And now, like, okay, in fairness, they probably should have got something out of the game when you look at the chances they've missed. But now he really has to think about the team, what player, like, he's going to get the job. So what players are good enough? What players does he have to get rid of? I mean, watching Lukaku on Sunday, despite his goals in the Champions League, I was kind of watching it going, Jesus, like, that one where he hit the crossbar. I mean, when you're paying £70 million for a striker, you're kind of like, really needs to score that. In those games against big, you know, your so-called big clubs anyway, you're not going to get many of those chances. And although I will say, like, the most amazing thing about that game, I didn't think it was a penalty, but then Aubameyang to get the penalty, and Aubameyang actually takes the exact same penalty that he took last week, aka a really bad one, and he's just lucky this time because for some reason David De Gea decides to dive before he's taken the penalty. Whereas and Aubameyang, I think, has spoken about this before, that he basically waits for the keeper to move before he hits the ball. And actually, he's actually looking directly at the goalkeeper rather than looking at the ball. And
no one has told De Gea then.
And like,
clearly not.
So like, well, like, you know, if that's his tactic, it's no wonder he's scored. You know,
it's a brave one to go talking about, because all of the pressure is on the attacker to score a penalty. There's no pressure on the penalty. The goalkeeper, because the goalkeeper is not expected to save them. Like, penalties should be scored.
Like, if you watched his penalty on Sunday and watched the penalty from the week before against Tottenham, they were the same penalty and they were both equally as bad. He was just lucky that this time De Gea dived the other way. Like, you know, like, look, every penalty that goes in is a good penalty according to commentators. But if you watch that penalty back, it's in the middle of the goal. It's not really hit very convincingly. It's just the fact that De Gea is already gone that it goes in. If De Gea had waited on his line, he was going to save it.
Yes.
So, and like, he has scored, his record before that penalty was 16 converted out of 23. It's not very convincing.
No, it's kind of like Messi level penalty.
No, so like, to be honest with you, okay, you can see why he wants to take it after what had gone on the week before. But I wasn't terribly, you know, when he was going up, I was going, oh, Jesus, I bet you he'll miss this. But anyway, he proved me wrong. Good win for Arsenal.
Great win for Arsenal, and properly in the hunt for the top four.
Big time in the hunt. Spurs, I don't know, like Spurs are looking like the longer Spurs stay in the Champions League, the better for Arsenal and United.
Yeah.
I expect United will bounce back. I mean, emotionally, I'm sure the Paris Saint-Germain game took a lot out of them. But, you know, it's just an example, though, like that, you know, Solskjaer does have a lot of big decisions ahead of him.
Yeah, a lot of huge ones, and particularly, well, there's a few players there you'd probably have picked out anyway from the Mourinho days that probably should have gone. Not sure who or what. Like, some of them have improved. Like, I guess Luke Shaw is actually showing himself to be one that's definitely staying. Pogba, actually, is another example of somebody who's...
There's a couple of players that will definitely be there. I mean, De Gea, he's the best player on the team.
Oh, yeah, no, of course, he will.
Pogba. but, like, you have... If Derek was here, he'd no doubt name a couple more. If Derek was here, he'd have strong opinions on a few. I noticed that Derek was I heard he needed the smelling salts after that defeat on Sunday. It was such a shocker. He was knocked out for the count.
Look, Arsenal actually have been, apart from the trashing at Liverpool and there were a couple of other defeats.
The defeat at West Ham and the defeat at Southampton. They went through a real wobbly patch there in December, early January, and they've recovered really well. They've won their last five Premier League games now at the Emirates.
Yeah, well, other than that, Europa League defeat.
They're 12 points better off than they were this time last year through the corresponding fixtures. So that's a serious amount of progress.
Well, look, we'll see you back in the Champions League at some point, I'm sure. Before we go,
we have no time to talk about Declan Rice now.
Oh, yeah, go on, give us a couple of minutes there.
Yeah, go.
What a load of nonsense. Shocked and appalled.
To be honest, I think it is a bit of a non-story.
I actually don't care.
Yeah, well, there's that. But
I'd have to
describe. Do I know who won Young Player of the Year last year? No.
Jack
Grealish won Young Player of the Year as well at one stage.
He did.
It's just embarrassing how many, like, every few months, weeks, whenever there's a squad announcement or whatever, anything kicks off the FAI, it just seems it's so many embarrassing moments we have to deal with as fans. Like that, it just looks, look like idiots.
He's not going to be there to pick up the award.
But
to be honest with you, if he was coming over to pick up the award, you'd go, ah, sure, look, fair enough. So, like, he's going to be there. But, like, he's not even coming.
Imagine
if he did. Imagine if he did.
I don't see the comedy factor in so many things. Like, what? Like, the birthday tweet was just so stupid.
Well,
but that's not just that. It's not just about Declan Rice. It's like the fact now that our team has... We essentially told Glenn Whelan he's retired and now he's back.
Well,
on merit.
Yeah.
But we essentially tried to retire him by giving him his send off and then he's back now. And it just seems like, again, it's management has changed, but it's still the same FAI. And it just seems like there's so many just embarrassing things that happen, whether it's with the fans and they're, you know, not giving tickets to people who are actually going to every single game away and they can't get tickets. And it just, every single few months there seems to be something that's very embarrassing for us. And I think the Declan Rice thing, maybe it won't be picked up in the British media. I assume it will be because there's a comedy factor to it. We just look like idiots. Like, how do you not have, I think Derek was saying, again, I'm just telling people what we talk about in our WhatsApp group, which is people should subscribe to that rather than listen to the show.
That wouldn't be a good idea.
No, but
I'm pretty sure
it wouldn't be a show anymore if there was just a WhatsApp. He's saying that there mightn't have been anyone else.
Proceedings have been launched.
but he just said, like, there mightn't be anyone else to it, like, or there wasn't anyone to stand it. There must be some other Irish player.
To keep the voting transparent and what have you, they had to give him the award.
Just give it to second place.
I would hope that, I was only looking at Arsenal's fixture list after the United game and saw that they've the Rennes match now this coming week, and then they don't have another Premier League match until they play Newcastle on April 1st. Which is a while away, the next couple of weeks are all going to be about international football, and I'd hope we'd have something positive to talk about for once with the Irish team. I'm hoping that they get off to a good start, particularly because this bloody European Championships is in Dublin, and it would be unbelievable if we qualified. And I do believe Mick McCarthy is the one who might get us there.
Yeah,
he's the similar positive approach that Solskjaer has, the similar feel-good factor.
I think this is something that would absolutely make Derek's blood boil. I think Mick McCarthy has more credence as a coach than Zidane. So don't be putting him in that in his like. I think he's done it enough at different clubs.
He certainly has.
But yeah, well, I get what you mean. He's the same kind of.
I wouldn't go saying no that he's that. But you're painting Zidane as basically this Egypt walking off the street.
He is. He is an Egypt walking.
He's like one of the worst players.
Until he manager was until he proves it.
He's won 3 Champions Leagues.
It's not enough.
Oh, Jesus. No one has ever won 3 Champions Leagues in a row.
Just the players.
Huh?
Because Mike Phelan was involved somehow.
Yeah. See, this is the only thing I will say. I'm talking about the feel-good factor. But like Solskjaer, as I keep saying, wait till we get into like November next year. I mean, we can play this clip back and I might have serious egg in my face, but I don't think so.
Well, you'd be lucky because we never seem to play any clips back.
Someday, Raph, we're going to go through the archives and play all the times I got things wrong.
It's just a lot of footage to listen to.
Well, we will do that. As I said, we were currently recording this as a Champions League game is going on. Ronaldo did score Juventus back in Atletico Madrid. Tune in on Friday to find out exactly what happened. But I think that sums us up for this week. Not much else to talk about. Next week, though, we're likely to have Stig Inge Bjørneby, who used to play for Liverpool back in the day, Wand of a Left Foot, also part of a Norway team that played Ireland in the 1994 World Cup. But myself and Jonathan Higgins will be chatting to him. But anyway, for this week, Joe Coffey, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure as always.
And Killian Woods.
Thanks, Raph.
Take it away, Johan.